Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by David Cox, Harvard Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology, as well as Computer Science, a member of Harvard's Center for Brain Science, and most importantly for today's conversation, the man behind MCB80X, a new Harvard X MOOC on the fundamentals of neuroscience. While most MOOC professors bring their best game to their massive online learning projects, Professor Cox is the first person I've met who's brought his own manifesto, one which promises to make MOOCs their own unique learning experience rather than just a really big version of a traditional classroom-based college course. Given that most MOOC providers and developers practice what they preach in terms of experimentation, I've seen some very cool and innovative things in the 24 or so online classes I've taken so far, whether those were the dialogic videos that brought such intimacy to my edX Greek Heroes course, or the crowdsourced argument contest that ended my Coursera MOOC course on logic and reasoning. But given the rapidity of MOOC evolution, those innovations were really of the version 1.5 variety, projects in which educators unhappy with the first 1.0 generation of courses used the opportunity of creating their own later courses to try some new things to see what worked. But each generation of course developers influences the next, which has given instructors like Professor Cox a chance to conceive of his project as different from the get-go. Which is why the three categories of innovation included in his manifesto, guided activity, learning by doing, and student-generated content, will be woven into every aspect of MCB80X. And what do those categories involve? Well, let's find out from the man himself. David Cox, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
First, can you tell us about your background, both regard to teaching and research at Harvard?
So I'm an assistant professor of molecular and cellular biology and of computer science here at Harvard. So my research is as a computational systems neuroscientist, and that basically means that I study how the brain works as a computer. That's what my lab does. In terms of teaching, I'm teaching a course called MCB80 and its online version, MCB80X, which are aimed at teaching people the fundamental groundwork of neuroscience.
And what drew you to create a course for edX?
All of this began when my department chair approached me. I'm brand new on the faculty, and there's a lot of interest and, frankly, apprehension about edX amongst the Harvard faculty. And when they saw someone young come in who had a background in doing work in media, particularly things online, I think they saw me and said, okay, well, maybe this is the guy who can carry our flag for this edX thing. And then since then, it's evolved such that now, thanks to incredible support from the deans, that actually my primary assignment in terms of teaching is just this online course. So as far as I know, I'm the first and only member of the faculty who's only teaching an online course this year.
And the reason we're talking is because you've made it a mission to do something very different than what people come to expect when they take a MOOC. Can you talk about the mission you've set up for yourself with MCB80X?
So with MCB80X, we wanted to really take advantage of the internet. Most MOOCs today are basically YouTube videos and some multiple choice questions added on. And don't get me wrong, it's great that universities are opening up and making their materials available to a wide audience. But to the extent that large lecture halls, introductory courses aren't our core competency in the first place. They aren't what makes Harvard great. You're in a lecture hall with 100 people, and what really makes the Harvard experience special is your interaction with your peers and interaction with the professor, interaction with the teaching staff. If you just take that experience and you take the worst part of it, which is the lecture hall, and then you make the lecture hall the size of the internet, then you've basically taken all of the worst parts and kept none of the good parts. That said, the internet's much more than just YouTube and multiple choice questions. You can do amazing things in a browser window. You can have amazing opportunities for students to participate. And while it's great in some sense that edX is making efforts like OpenCourseWare and iTunes U, taking that to the next level just in terms of institutional support, we really wanted to go beyond that and really try and make something that was worthy of the Harvard name, worthy of not just being online education, but being what education in general should be. And what that really means is pulling students in and having sort of rich interactions inside the browser window, simulations, and also having chances for students to participate and create content.
It looks like there are three areas you staked out for making your online course different. So let's go through all three, starting with guided activity. What will that consist of?
So the first pillar of what we're trying to do, we're calling guided interactivity. And the idea there is to not just have a video where I lecture, but to try and use the internet to have a conversation. So imagine if I were going to teach someone to play chess, and I'm actually teaching my daughter to play chess right now. You wouldn't lecture about the rules of chess and then give a multiple choice quiz about the rules of chess. And you wouldn't put somebody in a room with a chessboard and some chess pieces and ask them to figure it out. What you do instead, and what I'm doing with my daughter right now, is you sit down across a chessboard, you put just a few pieces on the board at a time, and you ask your student to move the pieces, and you interact. Sometimes I move the pieces, sometimes you move the pieces. So what we're doing with guided interactivity is creating a situation where, imagine a professor's lecture slides, if the professor every now and then asks you to reach out and manipulate the slides. And we can do this particularly in neuroscience because behind the scenes, a lot of the complicated dynamics that we're trying to teach students are basically able to be captured in mathematical models. So what we have is, imagine a cell membrane, and you can control the parameters of it. You can make the cell fire. We can build up a neuron piece by piece, and it's an actual dialogue. So I'll be talking, there'll be a video seamlessly. The video will change over without the student knowing to one of these interactive pieces. They'll continue to be voiceover. I'll keep talking. So we'll ask the student to do something, and then the whole simulation will wait. The whole dialogue will wait. Basically, what we've done is we've created sort of a heuristic version of me and the kinds of educational conversations we can have. So what happens next depends on what the student does. And right now we're doing very simple versions of this, but you can imagine this going very far, where you could have basically an automaton that's trying to model what the student knows and what the student's learning, and then can react to that. So I think this is a really exciting direction we can go in the future, really exploit the possibilities that the internet today give you.
And how about education on location?
Right. So one of the things that we saw when we looked at MOOCs when we were first piloting out this course was that most of MOOCs are filmed in lecture halls. So a lot of effort is being focused on lecture capture. And like I said, the lecture hall is one of the worst parts of the academic experience. It's sort of academia's dirty laundry. And frankly, there's no reason to be in a lecture hall. If it makes sense to teach something in a museum or in a lab or in a hospital, what we can do with MCB80X and what we're doing with MCB80X is we're filming those sections in place. So a few weeks ago, we were filming with the Scorpion to talk about neurotoxins. We were at the Museum of Science in their Theater of Electricity to talk about electrostatics, which is important for understanding how bioelectricity works. On Thursday, we're going to the New England Aquarium to talk about electric fish and to talk about other kinds of neurotoxins. So really a big part of this is that now the world is our classroom. And we can have a much more intimate experience, but also more broadly conceived educational experience. And I think it'll be fun for students.
And finally, student-generated content?
So I think this is one of the most exciting parts of what we're doing. So in addition to having students interact with these rich simulations, we're also encouraging students to do experiments in real life. Now, many courses, including online courses, have textbooks, and those cost, you know, up to $100. We're basically telling people, don't buy a textbook. There are plenty of good online resources. We'll point you to them. If you're going to spend any money on this course, what you really should buy is this lab kit that we've partnered with a company called Backyard Brains. And what this kit lets you do fairly inexpensively is to run real-life neuroscience experiments at home using invertebrates, so cockroaches, worms, things like that. And what we're doing is we're inviting students to do the experiments. We're providing lab manuals and video demonstrations, and then we're having the students do these experiments at home, and then we're encouraging them to film their experiments and then send them to us. Now, not everyone in the world can afford these things, and it's certainly not a required component of the course. But we wanted to have as many people from as many different kinds of backgrounds doing this. So to that end, we started a Kickstarter campaign. So Kickstarter is a company that allows you to crowdfund interesting and creative projects that might not otherwise be possible. And partnering with Backyard Brains, the company that created this hardware, we are launching a campaign to try and raise money to buy as many of these kits as we can for people around the world. Now, the strings attached to that are simple and few. We just ask that if we give you a free kit, you don't have to return it, but we just ask that you film what you do or you give us some documentation of how it went. And then we're going to aggregate all that together so that students can share and interact. At some level, this is just a microcosm of what the real scientific community is. People around the world doing experiments, reacting to each other, having a dialogue. And in many ways, that's the real revolution of the internet in the past 5 or 10 years. People, ordinary citizens getting involved in creating content and then sharing it with other people. So we're very excited to see where that takes us as well.
This lab device you talked about, can you describe it a little bit?
Sure. So it's basically a little bioamplifier. So it's a little box, a couple inches on a side, and coming from the box are a couple wires with little sort of needles on them. And what you can do is you can stick those needles into a living creature, in this case, a worm or a cockroach leg, and then you can actually record neuronal impulses in that living creature. Now, you might worry about the animal. It turns out that if you do the experiments the way we describe, the animal won't be harmed by them. So the worm can go back in the ground, the cockroach's leg will grow back, no big deal. But doing this, you can really get this experience that very few people get to get. So I heard my first neuron spiking. This is how they create these neural impulses called spikes. I didn't hear that until I was in graduate school. And once you've heard it, it's sort of magical. You want to study it further. It's like you're eavesdropping on the nervous system as it's working. What Backyard Brains has done is they've created this hardware cheaply with the mission of giving that experience to all ages of people all around the world who haven't gone to graduate school and bought specialized equipment for doing these kinds of experiments. So what we're doing is we're trying to make this as widely available as possible so other people can kind of share in this excitement of science and can also do experiments that haven't been done before. Now, we have a strict set of ethical guidelines that we ask students to adhere to. So absolutely no vertebrate creatures of any sort can be used for experiments. Really, you can only do it on invertebrates. But there's really a huge amount of interesting science, including science that hasn't been done before, that you can do using this hardware on everyday creatures.
And I'm curious, the experiments your students are doing, are everybody going to be doing the same experiments and the same experiences, or is there going to be some real new science going on?
We hope there'll be a little bit of both. So we're providing lab manuals for students to sort of do the first order basic experiment where you can move little hairs on a cockroach's leg and you can hear how that causes firing. But there are plenty of interesting experiments that can still be done. So the folks at Backyard Brains have started doing experiments where they measure the action potential conduction velocity, so how fast the nerve impulses travel in a worm going one way or going the other way. And it was previously not known that there's actually an asymmetry there, and there's really interesting science about that. Or, testing in different conditions of different temperatures. Testing these things on insects which might not be indigenous to the places where people normally do these experiments, so people in sort of far-flung parts of the world. So it's an ambitious goal, but we think that there's real possibility for people to develop new experiments, to develop new understanding, and possibly contribute to real science.
And tell me a little bit about this Kickstarter campaign. I know you gathered some $4,000 or $5,000 in the first 4 days. Is it invertebrate haters who are making these donations, or where's this money coming from?
I hope not. We've had a really fantastic response to the Kickstarter campaign so far. And it's been interesting to actually look at a postmortem of who's contributing, because it really spans a wide range. People contributing $1 and then sending us an email about how excited they are about taking the course or about what we're doing, all the way up to we've had money from people who are active in the venture capital space in Silicon Valley, to just a huge range of different kinds of people contributing to this project. So I think in general, there's a good deal of interest in taking MOOCs farther than they've gone. And there's a good deal of interest in sort of citizen science, where people do real science in their home, and it's not the sort of rarefied process. So I think that's largely who's been making this campaign so successful. But we have many days left to go, so I'm sure we'll get an even wider range of people as the thing goes on.
One of the advantages of MOOCs, as opposed to traditional college classrooms, is you're not necessarily just teaching 18 to 22-year-olds. Thoughts about who this course might appeal to in terms of people younger, maybe high school students or some of the older students who might be taking this course?
So we're already getting a good deal of feedback through sort of secondary channels on social media and also direct emails from a variety of non-traditional student types. So we do see that there are a number of high school students, and I think there's no good reason why neuroscience shouldn't be one of the standard core courses that high school students take. And I think a bright student who might be looking for another AP course to take, advanced placement course, I think taking a MOOC on neuroscience is sort of an interesting alternative. So we're getting a fair bit of play there. We're also getting emails from the occasional 40 or 50 year old electrical engineer. And a common pattern we see in those emails is, I've always been interested in neuroscience, but for whatever reason, I didn't follow that path. So there's a bit of a sense of going back and scratching an itch that either they didn't because of circumstance or because they thought they couldn't. We've also gotten emails from students who describe themselves as non-traditional learners, who either because of learning disabilities or just different learning styles, felt like they were shut out of science. And having the ability to take a course like this that's more engaging, that's broken up into sort of smaller chunks, and that can be done at their own pace, I think that does open it up to a lot of people. Now, we haven't run the course yet, so it'll be interesting to see what fraction of people stick with us, and it'll be interesting to see what fraction of people show up, you know, by the time we start. But it is exciting to be talking to more than just the average 18 to 22-year-old.
And finally, a lot of people looking at projects like yours to see if MOOCs can truly break out of the lecture hall they seem to be trapped in. What kind of responses have you gotten from your colleagues on this project, and where are you hoping this project might lead vis-a-vis not just your course, but other MOOC courses in the future?
We've had a tremendous response from my colleagues, both at the high level. As I mentioned earlier, none of this would be possible if dean-level people at Harvard hadn't signed off on it, and they've been extremely enthusiastic about what we're doing. And then meanwhile, my colleagues on the faculty are also very excited about this, particularly my colleagues in biology, who are looking at how they might eventually someday get involved. We're definitely operating in sort of frontier land, so it's not been easy going all the way. But I think there's a good chance that we could, you know, use this as a test case to pioneer, or at least broaden people's perspectives on what's possible in a MOOC. I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of good ideas out there. But unfortunately, because so many of the early entrants are basically doing lecture capture, there's been some frustration that more isn't possible. And our hope is to show that we can do more, and that it's not even terribly expensive to do more.
Well, fascinating project. I'm looking forward to hearing how the course goes. Thanks for joining us on Degree of Freedom.
Thanks so much.
That was Harvard's David Cox, the man behind MCB80X, The Fundamentals of Neuroscience. And before you run out and begin digging up earthworms to experiment on, I'd like to talk about how the ideology behind MCB80X fits into wider discussions of how academic subjects should be taught. Most students will have heard the saying, "Tell me and I'll forget, show me and I may remember, involve me and I'll understand," at least once while in school, often intoned as a wise ancient Chinese proverb, although it's really a quote from Benjamin Franklin. Like its pedigree, this quote is often misinterpreted, usually in order to signify the uselessness of things like lectures versus teaching methods based on more active engagement of the learner. But such an all-or-nothing interpretation tends to discount the fact that most of the subjects we study cover different categories of material, each of which is best taught using different teaching and assessment techniques. For example, I spent a number of years working in the field of digital literacy education, and within that field, a consensus has emerged that sees digital literacy as consisting of three components: a specific body of knowledge about what a microprocessor is and how memory works, for example, a specific set of skills, how to use current relevant hardware and software, and critical thinking abilities, such as how to think logically and problem solve. With all due respect for Ben Franklin, knowledge is still best learned by having things explained to you, preferably by a skilled teacher who knows more about the subject than you do. So in learning the knowledge component of a subject, things like lectures and reading, or assessment techniques involving well-crafted multiple-choice questions that allow you to demonstrate an understanding are perfectly valid ways to instruct. Skills, on the other hand, need hands-on experience before they can become internalized. As anyone who's ever tried to master a piece of software or some lab technique will tell you, unless you put the skills you are taught to work immediately, they tend to get lost. So in the case of skills, we want students to be able to perform tasks by laying hands on the computer keyboard or lab device, for instance, and be tested using assessment techniques that measure actual performance. Critical thinking is an interesting hybrid of knowledge and skills since, as I discovered when I created my own course in the subject last year, there are specific things you need to know in order to think critically, notably the fundamentals of logic and the tools of persuasion. But if you don't put that knowledge to work in the real world right away, it doesn't stick. Now, these three strands, knowledge, skills, and critical thinking, are intimately connected. For what good is mastering this or that technique in the chemistry lab unless you already have a grasp of the foundational concepts of molecular theory? And when it comes time to draw conclusions, that's when the critical thinking parts of your brain are in the driver's seat. And speaking of brains, as David described his new neuroscience course, you could see how it's been built around these same pillars of knowledge, skills, and critical thought. For even though he's moved his lectures outside of the classroom and turned them into investigations and interviews, you're still being presented with knowledge you did not know before it was explained to you by experts. Whenever the lecture stops and you're asked to interact with some on-screen element in order to better understand how cell chemistry works, for example, you are now involved with performance-based teaching and assessment that allows you to master a skill. Similarly, learning how to perform experiments on live invertebrates is an exercise in skills development, built, it should be noted, on understanding the fundamental knowledge that David and his guests and colleagues have explained to you. When it comes time to interpret the results of your experiments, neither knowledge nor skill, alone or together, are going to get you where you need to go. But it is your brain's own critical reasoning processes that allow you to synthesize what you've learned and apply it to generating hypotheses, seeing patterns, following trends, and reaching conclusions. So while I hope that other MOOC providers will look at what's been done in some of the more envelope-pushing online learning projects as they conceive of how they like their own classes to work, I'm also hoping they first take a hard look at how their own subject matter breaks down so that some of the cool technology we get so excited about gets applied in just the right places. And with that, it's time to say goodbye. But just until next week, when I'll be back with the next Degree of Freedom podcast.